welcome to Worlds Apart. Generals like to say that the best teacher of military strategy is in fact war. As costly and cruel as it may be, it dispels illusions and brings everyone in contact with reality. What have been the tactical and strategic lessons of the Ukrainian conflict so far, both for the region and for the world? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Rakesh Sharma, retired Lieutenant General of the Indian Army and Distinguished Fellow at the Vivekananda International Foundation. Lieutenant General, it's great pleasure, great honor for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Sarah.
Now, you know, I've been interviewing a lot of Indian guests lately, and one of the things that I was struck by is, first, the amount of attention that the Indian observers and Eastern observers in general are paying to this conflict, and second of all, is this very detailed, cold-blooded, cool-headed analysis, which is quite different from all this emotional moralizing that is more typical of the Western observers, I think. Do you think the Indians in particular or Eastern observers in general approach war and this conflict differently?
Yeah, thank you. See, the fact of the matter is that it's a war, and we analyze all wars like this. We would have analyzed Iraq wars also similarly, even Afghanistan, for that matter, Iraq wars. So each of the wars is analyzed in a manner to learn the best lessons there. Now, this is a later day conventional war. Lots and lots of people were saying conventional wars are passe. They won't happen again. But then you see a conventional war of this kind, and we can't compare this with Nagorno-Karabakh. This is a much higher scale war. And this there is a superpower involved, Russia. So one was expecting a kind of warfare which will teach us many lessons of modern warfare and how future forces are characterized or will be characterized in times to come. So that's a rationale for us to study the war in that light.
Now, one of the things that I think has been the feature of discussions about conflict over the last couple of years is the presumption that all wars from now on will be proxy wars or some sort of hybrid wars, that this kinetic fight between the forces is no longer a feature of reality. And yet, as you point out in your articles, the war in Ukraine showed that conventional war is still very much, you know, the presence. In what way do you think conventional war has changed? Because it's both a conventional conflict and to some extent a modern conflict.
So wars are messy affairs. All wars are messy affairs. And you cannot guarantee what a war will turn out to be. In fact, the very definition of the word war is changing. People talk about proxy wars and political wars and economic wars and all types of wars. When we're talking about a war, we're talking about a two-state conflict. So the two-state conflicts are changing in a big way in manners of non-contact wars or non-kinetic wars. This turned out to be many wars put together. You see, the West has come out with the multi-domainal warfare. This gun turned out to be different altogether because there was, in my opinion, a coercion being carried out on one side. There was an asymmetric warfare being carried out on one side. There was a proper conventional war being carried out on a different front in the same context. So there were two, three wars being fought out in different manner altogether. So they bring out different lessons in this manner.
You mentioned that any war is usually fought between two immediate sides, and we have the Russians and the Ukrainians here, but I think you would agree with me that the number of participants, proxy participants in this war is much larger. And in fact, I think what the Russians have been trying to do, the Russian leadership has been trying to do over the last couple of weeks and months with their statements is to sort of call the American bluff of portraying themselves as not being participant to this conflict. And in fact, both Putin and his defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, said recently that they see that this conflict as a direct confrontation between Russia and NATO. Do you think the Russians, for the time being, have been successful in turning what Americans want to be a proxy war into a war where all the participants are manifested?
Now, the fact of the matter is, when it started, actually, you can go back to 2014 when Crimea happened, and 2015, and subsequently as events progressed. So the Ukrainians were trained, and they trained well, and, you know, into those modern warfare techniques by the West, NATO especially, in the course of the last 6 to 7 years. When the war commenced, even before the mobilization was being carried out, and as it commenced initially, one could deem it that there were expectations that this war might not actually happen. It might, the mobilization that the Russians had done in a big manner, including the exercise in Belarus, would fizzle out in time after some kind of portion being carried out. But when the war happened initially, certainly it was a war between Russia and Ukraine. As time has passed, I think, and when you see the statement of the speech of President Putin on 21st of September, he says it's a war of Russia against the West in general. Well, when you talk about war of economics, of sanctions, the war of weaponization of economics, the weaponization of sanctions, you know, there are multifarious wars on here. So when you can't say it's only a war between, and the geopolitical war by itself. So it's not a war only between Ukraine and Russia. That's being fought on the front, yes. But then there is immense amount of proxy support that comes into Ukraine, which actually facilitates the Ukrainians to take war. But you take a step back into any war. See, when Azerbaijan and Armenia fought 2 years ago, there was support being carried out by countries from outside. So the proxy countries always get involved into supporting the belligerents to fight a war.
But Lieutenant General, I think there's a difference between supporting various parties because you want to achieve your local interest and using a country specifically to attack your adversary. Where's the chicken and where's the egg in this case when we look at the, you know, this whole balance of power between Russia and the West?
See, Oksana, the fact of the matter is that the initiative to commence the war was taken by Russia. You know, right? Whether you call it war or you call it special military operations, worldwide it's called a war. So the initiative was taken by Russia. And subsequently, the West came in. The West, you know, it was not that it was a planned support. But I agree with you today, if there has been a little change into the war situation on the line of control or the front lines, it has come because of the assistance provided by the West. Otherwise, we all knew the caliber the Ukrainian forces had to fight the war. Without the support of the West, it would have been well nigh impossible for Ukrainians to stand before the might of the Russian armed forces.
Now, I know that the Indians appreciate Russian literature, so I will allow myself to quote one of the classical Russian writers, Anton Chekhov, who wrote once that if a gun is on the war in the opening scene, it is supposed to fire towards the end. And the tensions between Russia and NATO have been going on for quite some time, and Russia has been signaling its extreme displeasure with NATO expansion plans for quite some time, and yet for some reason, I think there was a deep belief in the West that Russia would not act and would not use its military force to defend what it sees as strategic interest. I wonder, why is that? Why is there so much surprise in the West that Russia would commence this military operation after all the efforts, diplomatic efforts, to come to some sort of negotiated agreement with the West regarding Ukraine and regarding the expansion of NATO failed?
So the issue comes up as, what is existential crisis? When a nation says that I'm having existential crisis, Russia was always stating this obvious, that the NATO has been pushing for a war. And many of the American authors, including Henry Kissinger and John Mersimer, and all those who have stated that NATO must not get involved into this kind of belligerence, which forces Russia to show its hands against Ukraine. So this thing was coming for the last 15, 20 years, certainly from 2008 onwards. So it's not that it suddenly sprung up on one fine day. But having said that, there is a distaste to conventional wars that's been going across in the world. Who wants a conventional war? Are we going back to 1914 or 1915? So we were not expecting this war to win. The world was not expecting a war to begin like that.
But I want to ask you, as a person who has deepest respect for the military strategy, and this is the art, this is the science, this is, you know, war at the end of the day is something that people study, that they strategize about. Do you think Russia had any other means defending what it deems its strategic interest? And I think you would agree with me that, you know, not having NATO too close is in the strategic interest of Russia. Most of the people, most of the military analysts I talk to agree, even if they don't like Putin. Did Russia have any other means at its disposal to defend its interest and to repel NATO from encroaching ever closer towards its borders?
Look, we who are the soldiering community have seen death in a close quarters with bullets being fired in anger. And we are the first ones to say war must not take place. So every known option to avoid a war must be taken to avoid a war. If it is unavoidable, naturally we go ahead with a war like that. So, you know, to say that, that, you know, all options had been tried and put behind us, even by the Russians, before they commence the war, I don't think that would be true.
Okay, can you be more direct and specific? What else could Russia have done? And I ask you in good faith, as somebody who has you know, goodwill both towards Ukrainians and towards the Russians.
So we have best of relations with Ukrainians. So I think, I mean, we have best of relations and we wish to have best of relations with all countries in the world. But, you know, see, look at the oil pipelines and the dependence that Ukraine has on oil from Russians totally. So if you wanted what you have done to what Russians have done to Nord 1, Nord Stream 1, could have been done to the pipelines that are flowing through Ukraine. Or you could have said, okay, we will blockade you, or say, Black Sea. You know, instead of actually launching offensive, you could have found many other methods of coercing a nation to get onto your side. Then fire the first, cock the gun and fire a bullet.
But Lieutenant General, it wasn't, I understand that using economic mechanisms would have saved many lives. But, you know, at the same time, there was information, I think now proven, that the West was actively militarizing Ukraine, especially in the early, not only from 2014, but especially in the early 2021, 2022. If that was happening in your disputed border areas, would the Indian Army also respond through economic measures, or would you think seriously about using your military potential?
Look, we know even now the United States has supported Pakistan, who is a belligerent against us for a very long time. This as recent as the month of September this year. So, you know, which of course we have objected to. The fact is that the neighbors are being addressed in this manner. That doesn't tell us to go and charge across the borders and to take a fight with Pakistan, despite the fact that we know that they do proxy support across to Jammu and Kashmir. But you know, we are not itching for a fight. We are not gunning for a fight. But we are prepared for it. We are prepared to do the best possible. So there is a preparation for a war, and then there is an issue of going for a war. I would still reckon to say that if there are opportunities available, and then the opportunities could have been sought. Why not? See, today Europe is split into many parts, even today, in dealing with the situation between Russia and Ukraine. And you hear many voices coming out of Europe. I am sure we could have found a great amount of pressures to be built through Europe, which Russia was growing, relationships were growing better and better, to get on to a denial of this information. See, President Macron has said NATO was brain dead not too long ago. So, you know, there were voices here.
Let's continue this discussion after a very, very short break. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Rakesh Sharma, retired Lieutenant General of the Indian Army and Distinguished Fellow at the Vivekananda International Foundation. Lieutenant General, before the break, we were talking about how this war could have been avoided, but it's already a reality, so yeah, we have to deal with it as it is. I'm sure you know that a few days ago, the Russian president announced partial mobilization, which caused a lot of unease in the Russian society, which up until recently had followed this conflict from the television screens. Now it has to draw the reservists into the field. And, you know, many people, while supporting abstract decisions of the government, feel quite differently about it when they have to contribute to that with their own efforts. So I wonder, how do you think that move to join more reservists, we are talking about 300,000 people, how do you think it will change the dynamics of this conflict?
Well, that's an interesting thing. Firstly, right, I believe that there was serious strategic miscalculations by the Russian armed forces or the political hierarchy even when the war started. Because they misunderstood the kind of coercion that is possible, misunderstood the kind of support the ethnic Russians will come and provide to the armed forces. There were many other issues of the, and the Western support itself. Now, I am getting a little anxious on the point of no return that we are reaching. So one issue that you have raised is the mobilization that has been ordered on 21st of September, which is 300,000 soldiers. And second point of no return is the referenda being carried out. Mobilization, manpower always helps in this scenario. Right from beginning, one of the biggest miscalculations was the quantum of force that the Russian armed forces brought to bear against Ukraine. People who were studying the war said that the quantum of force that had been brought across in Belarus or against through Belarus or against Kyiv or Sumy was grossly insufficient to do the task. So that is why there was too much of switching of manpower being carried out from the Western district, the Southern district, from Belarus on to the Donbass area, from Donbass area to Kherson. This is not how switching a 2,000 kilometer front area mobilization always helps. Now, having said that, there are many negatives here. Negatives are, where is the manpower to be used? Firstly, what's the quality of manpower going to come from there? Is it those people who did 2 years of conscription and they are now in 30s and they will join this area? So the quality of conscription and how soon will they come? I think I'll end here saying that the Russians are attempting to freeze the lines, solidify the lines of contact in various areas before the winter sets in. So they are in a hurry to get forces to bring about some kind of freezing of lines, which are now actually shifting too much.
Well, this is actually what I've heard from some of the Russian analysts as well, that these new troops will be deployed not so much as frontline soldiers, but rather as sort of proxy border guards that will have to take care of this expanding territory. And we are talking about 100,000 square kilometers where, you know, four regions of Ukraine where the referenda for joining Russia are taking place this very minute as we speak.
Yeah.
I wonder, what do you think will be the significance of these potential changes of borders in this entire conflict? I mean, this is not a confirmed decision yet, but judging from preliminary figures, the overwhelming majority of people who still live in those territories, they want to join Russia. So if that indeed happens, what do you think it would mean for the trajectory of the conflict?
So if the referendum takes place and people, and I'm not actually venturing into who wins the referendum at all, since the Ukrainians also feel it is their territory and the West also is getting so seriously involved here, I don't see an end to this conflict. Maybe the war may have ceasefire, but that heart, like Crimea, but Crimea was taken over by the Russians, but the Crimea always rankled in the minds of the Ukrainians. And all the time, Crimea was being brought across here. So all the time, issues of Kherson or issues of Zaporizhia or Mariupol, all these issues will keep remaining into this contact for a very long time to come. This is not ending, even if there is a ceasefire, it's not going to end as all quiet on the Western front.
Lieutenant General, I'm sure you would agree with me, there is always pros and cons, and there is no perfect strategy for decision making, especially when you deal with a conflict. But what I'm hearing from, again, some of the Russian analysts is that when taking this decision to support the referenda, Vladimir Putin also had a military sort of strategy in mind, in the sense that if those territories are now under constant bombardment by Western and especially American weapons, high precision weapons, but if they are considered by Russia as, regardless of whether the West recognizes or not, if Russia considers themselves as part of, you know, its own territory, it would use different strategy, it would use different weapons to defend it. Do you think that stance in the Russian position is likely to change Western calculus? Or do you think some of the Western sponsors of this conflict are going to also seek to up the ante?
I don't see any relenting coming from the West at all. See, the Russian strength was heavy artillery, heavy bombardment, firepower. Historically, that was part of their doctrines. They didn't do the same thing in Kyiv. They didn't do it in Bucha. They didn't do it in Irpin. They didn't, Sumy. But they did this in Mariupol. So there is a difference how wars are fought. The kind of firepower that the West has pumped into the Ukrainians, I don't think they're going to relent in times to come. So this is active line of control, as we call it, or whatever name you give it, that active line of control will retain itself, despite what referenda takes place in whatever time. And there will also be people behind the scene, the fifth columnists and, you know, all these private military companies, etc., who will be constantly nitpicking and targeting areas, and like what has happened in Crimea, in the airports, etc. So I don't see any kind of good peaceful situation emanating in a short while. I think we are reaching a point of no return.
Now, you mentioned people behind the scenes, and Ukrainian nationalists have a historically venerated tradition of partisan or guerrilla warfare. Even Joseph Stalin, back in the 1950s, with his iron fist tactics, couldn't suppress it fully. And we are now seeing, even in academic literature, more and more support from Western and American quarters for this kind of insurgency. How do you think Russia should address it as a threat? Again, not from a moral perspective, but from a strategic and tactical perspective.
So they'll have to get on with it requires a full-time agency to sort out these issues of constant insurgency that will emanate and that will continue. Because the population, even if in referendum they support and it comes out figures of this kind, they will be substantial population which will not be in favor of the Russians. Everybody is not going to be in the Russian.
What makes you believe that? Because, I mean, if you look at the figures for the referenda, the support is overwhelming. And again, the Crimean example, sure, there were some people who were not very happy with the Russians coming in, but the overwhelming majority of people in Crimea supported it. And Crimea, by and large, stayed pretty peaceful since 2014 when it changed its national affiliation.
So I see a streak of nationalism, which was as not appreciated even before the war began. So that streak of nationalism and Ukrainian nationalism, despite the fact that they were neo-Nazis and all that, those we are following Azov Battalion, we know all these neo-Nazi units which have been there. But having said that, there would be a percentage of people who would be inimical, who will target the depth areas and logistics areas and the lines of communication. So you have to establish grids. Now, the armed forces will have to turn themselves into that kind of thing, like what we did in Afghanistan at one time. Created grids and created areas where, you know, there will be protection system. A new systemic will have to evolve into these areas occupied. Otherwise, even one blast takes place, puts the whole issue into a back burner.
You mentioned before that there is a difference in which wars are thought. Fought. And if you actually look at the way the Russians conducted their operation, a rather slow movement. They tried to avoid any urban warfare. They didn't bomb cities like, for example, the Americans did in Fallujah, yeah, or even the Russians did in Grozny during the Second Chechen yeah War. So there was a different approach towards, I think, both, you know, Russian-owned military forces and the local populations. Do you think that says something? Do you think that perhaps explains why initially the Russians didn't have this, you know, great success that you and others were expecting, simply because they decided that they will take it as slow as it needs to be for the sake of, you know, first of all, protecting people, but also making this success more lasting?
They haven't done it. But this is the kind of firepower that the armed forces are organized into. But they didn't do it. They didn't do it on the Kyiv side of it. But they did it in Mariupol. They have done it some places of mass destruction in the areas of Luhansk. Because, you know, the war in Luhansk turned out to be a typical force-on-force battle. That's a different thing. The Kyiv side was coercion and they didn't do it. Kherson, they have not destroyed the city at all. I mean, there has been a differentiation on how wars were fought. Like I said earlier, different wars were being fought in different manner in different areas, or sectorally. And we have to study each one of differently. I think there is merit in your argument saying that there was a tying down of the military hands by the political masters in how the wars will be fought. And that's one of these major learning points, which I've also written in somewhere else. There's a major learning point as to the military strategies are now dictated by the political masters as to how this will be fought. This changed in Donbass. Yeah.
And Lieutenant General, if I may, I want to ask you one last question. You mentioned the point of no return a couple of times, and I think I would agree with, I would even say that we have reached it already, because referenda, again, regardless of whether the West or the world recognizes them, are irreversible. You know, Russia is not going to turn and walk back away from that. But you can also argue that they present an opportunity for all the sides to sort of count their losses, cut their future losses, and decide on what they're going to do next. Is it likely at this point? Do you think there will be a sort of a sobering moment for all the sides involved to try to assess the situation and perhaps change their strategy?
If that happens, it will be good, but I don't foresee it. It's my personal opinion of it. I don't foresee it because whatever you might say, Ukrainians will feel that this territory, that the four oblasts, or I mean, three odd oblasts, because Kherson fully is not with Russians, neither is Zaporizhia fully with Russian, nor is Donetsk with Russian fully. So the fact is that they will think our territory has been lost. It will rankle in the mind of the Ukrainian population and the government for a long time to come. That it will say, okay, what is done. No, it won't happen this way. It doesn't happen. You have any loss of territory, whatever kind, it rankles for generations altogether.
Well, Lieutenant General, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts in such a direct way. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.